Okay, good afternoon everyone. The previous three presentations have really given us an excellent overview of the state of the nation at the moment in terms of optical Cherenkov telescopes here in the Mediterranean. I use the term here loosely as we're in Europe. And what I plan to do today is, in the next 15 minutes or so, is really look to the future and start to talk, as has been alluded to in the talks already, about cubic kilometre scale devices. So Antares and Nestor, clearly, they're, as you've heard already, building and deploying first generation devices in the Med. You've just heard from Paolo that NEMO is studying technological options for the KM3 infrastructure. What I want to do is really highlight the amount of progress that there's been in this field since the last neutrino conference in 2002. In particular, we had a very successful workshop in Amsterdam last October, which featured a large fraction of the collaborators from all three of the teams there. And also, interestingly, we had a lot of industrial presentations as well, particularly people like Hamamatsu, Photonis, and ETL. They didn't just turn up with photo tubes, they actually gave talks, and we learned a lot from that particular workshop. And that really was the catalyst to spur us towards writing a design study for European Union FP6 money, which was written in March of this year. Sorry, which is the pointer? Is this one? Yeah. Okay, so probably first of all, I should just try and put the whole thing into context and say, why the Mediterranean? We've seen these sky maps already. There's obvious that these are sky maps for purely upcoming muons or neutrinos, obviously. So, but clearly there's complementarity there to IceCube. It's already been said that as well as complementarity in the sky view, there is also a nice overlap due to the latitude, essentially, of sites in the Med. It's a nice overlap, which gives you the opportunity, if you start to see sources, to do systematic checks with a device that's based at the South Pole. Availability of deep sites, and coupled with that is the third point there. The Mediterranean gets very deep very quickly, so you can actually work at a deep site. You've seen this already when in the Antares and the Nestor presentations. These sites are really quite close to the mainland, so logistically that's quite attractive. Obviously, you've not got to go on a sort of 15-day cruise before you actually get to the place to make a deployment. Quite often, it's conceivable to get out to the site, make some form of deployment, and return within the day. We've already seen as well that the Mediterranean water has long scattering length, and that leads to excellent pointing accuracy, obviously desirable in the search for astrophysical sources of neutrinos. And also as well, obviously, when you deploy in water, you have the option there, if you have some faulty or damaged detector elements, to redeploy, resurface, repair and maintain. So much of this slide has been said already, but I'll just quickly rush through it again. So what's the motivation behind a cubic kilometre scale detector? Well, really, it's to go searching for these wealth of astrophysical sources that Professor Mannheim discussed in the first talk this morning. In particular, the two different approaches, the classic approaches, are to do point-like sources. The motivation there is often to look at high-energy gamma-ray sources, known high-energy gamma-ray sources, and look for associated neutrinos. So there's point-like searches, there's a measurement of the diffuse flux, and then, of course, as we've heard as well, there's the possibility for looking for the decay products of neutralino annihilation in what's called a classic indirect search for neutralino dark matter that's accumulated at the center of astrophysical objects such as the sun, or may be coalescing around the black hole at the center of the galaxy. So a large effective area will obviously permit this to be done with improved precision and sensitivity compared to the projects that we've just heard about. So one thing we're looking to do is to really optimize the detection efficiency, which is classically measured as an effective volume, reconstruction of neutrino direction and also the ability to reject backgrounds, obviously, whilst keeping costs to a minimum. And that point I will sort of come back to time and time again. We cannot scale easily the detectors that we have at the moment to cubic kilometre scale without making some cost savings. So just, we've seen this sort of plot earlier today, and apologies, I haven't got the latest Amanda results on there. They've come in here today, that what we've heard today, but what we're really doing here in terms of scientific motivation, and this is in the context of diffuse fluxes, we're really looking to drive this limit down into this 10 to minus 8, 10 to minus 9 region in these particular units, E squared d phi dE, way past the Waxman-Bacall limit that Professor Mannheim explained in his talk, and into an area where many of these astrophysical sources, have interesting potentially interesting neutrino fluxes. So, in designing a cubic kilometre detector, there are an enormous number of interrelated items to consider, and I'm sure I've missed an arrow or two off here. Let me know if I have. But what the workshop in Amsterdam addressed in October essentially was these particular items, and it's very much the sort of proceedings from that workshop that I'm going to go through in the next few minutes. One of the questions is detector architecture. We've already seen different approaches to this, and there are very different approaches. And I think that's a positive thing. We can learn from that. You know, the fact that people have gone and done things in different ways means, first of all, there's an enormous amount of expertise out there. And secondly, you know, we've got options. We haven't all done it the same way. So, I mean, one can sort of start when starting to assess the capability of these devices in terms of making simulations, working out sensitivities, effective volumes, etc. You can work with different sort of, if you like, generic style detectors. Probably the most sort of naive one is the homogeneous strings of detectors with the photomultipliers sort of dotted up the string. That's probably the most naive one, as I say, but the problem there is you've got an awful lot of deployment points, and as I'm going to come on to, in order to drive costs down, one of the things that bears a lot of the cost with these type of things is the sea operations. So anything that can obviate the need for lots of sea operations may be attractive. Then you have, for example, the Nestor-style approach, which is to actually put in essentially a number of these strings all in one mechanical structure side by side in one single deployment. So you've got an array where you've got a sparsely populated array of closely clustered strings. These types of, and here a sort of NEMO type approach, one that's been considered by NEMO, which is to, it's a little bit like a hybrid between the two, putting multiple PMTs at each level, vertical level, in the detector. So there's a lot of questions to answer there. How do you actually sort of lay out your detector architecture? What's your optimal string spacing? If you're going to cluster, you've got two sort of spacings to consider. And also, how many OMs do you want to look up and how many OMs do you want to look down? Okay, so some of these parameters are well known, some of them are less well known, but if you want to start making calculations, you've got to plug something in. We've heard a lot about water properties already, absorption, scattering, dispersion. We need to understand optical backgrounds, things like currents. There was a question on sedimentation, quite rightly so. We need to understand how the optical transmission varies as a function of time. And what we want to really work out is these things in my wish list on my second slide, effective volume, angular resolution, energy resolution, and it would be nice if you had some sensitivity to cascades as well to start picking up the new tau nu e, for example. So here's the result of some of the calculations that have been done at the moment, and you can see that these are similar to the ones that Paolo gave because they're a function of different K40 backgrounds. But what you can see, what is worth pointing out, is right up here at the highest energies, you really are for a sort of 5,000 to 6,000 PMT detector, you really are achieving that holy grail of a cubic kilometer, and in fact just over a cubic kilometer in terms of effective volume. And at the same time, really due to the excellent water properties in the med, the very long scattering length, you're getting down now to pointing accuracies. This is as is traditionally done in with neutrino telescopes, the median angle, but down to pointing accuracies sub 0.1 degree. Okay, so some of the things you've got to consider. We've heard a lot about junction boxes in the last few talks. For those who are not educated in the ways and wherefores of neutrino telescopes, the junction box is really I think of it as an incredibly expensive patch panel that sits between the electro-optical cable that goes to shore and the device. So it really is a thing that sort of multiplexes out the power to the different detector elements, takes data from the different detector elements, and it's really that interface between the shore and the device. There are a lot of things here to consider, and I'm not sort of proposing any answers to these. I'm just trying to give you, the audience, a feel for sort of some of the questions that are being asked at the moment and some of the problems we're going to have to solve in order to realize a cubic kilometer detector. What do you go for, AC or DC? Do you have redundancy? Do you have more than one electro-optical cable? The electro-optical cables are obviously expensive. Wet mateable connectors. A lot of the work that's been done so far has actually involved either subs or ROVs, these remote operated vehicles, making submarinal connections. You need dry, wet mateable connectors for that actually make the electrical and the fiber optic connection underwater, and those are incredibly expensive. Thank you. Can we go to dry mateable? Can we make the connection on the surface and go to dry mateable? This starts to reduce the number of connectors, which really are very expensive. We've heard from Paolo already as well the possibility of actually having a hierarchy of junction boxes rather than one single junction box, moving out to having primary and secondary junction boxes. We have to consider materials as well. And Paolo mentioned in his talk this idea of possibly encapsulating some of the metallic devices in something like fiberglass to resist corrosion. Obviously, we're going to put this thing down in the water for at least 10 years or so. Right, so sea operations, I've already mentioned a lot of the cost. We've seen different approaches here, taking strings and putting them off the back of a boat into the water. The Nestor approach, the Nestor Tower so far did it this way, but the final approach will be to use some form of ballasted sea platform and work off the ballasted sea platform. Again, we need to really think very carefully about sea operations. Any way of avoiding using things like submarines and ROVs saves you money because they're very expensive. So if we can do things on the surface, if we can make dry connections on the surface, that helps. Another thing that's been looked at is, and this is just at the sort of prototyping stage in shallow water tests, the possibility of actually making self-connecting systems that you have this basically on the seabed. This is attached to a tether cable from a ship, comes down, and the connection is made, again, without the need for ROVs and et cetera at the seabed. Okay, photo detection, the holy grail. I mean, basically, the eyes of the detector are photo tubes. We're currently really limited by the 17-inch spheres that we use, You can go as big as 13 inches, the Hamamatsu used by Nestor. But what we want to really do is be able to sort of maybe improve quantum efficiency. That's the main holy grail. But if you can increase your photocathode area, obviously that sort of feeds into your effective volume. Wide angular coverage, if possible, good single photon resolution. And this is where the manufacturers are going to come in, I hope. And this is just one example of a presentation given by Hamamatsu in the workshop where they showed a prototype HPD, which has excellent N photon resolution there. There's a single photon, two photon, three photo electron peaks, etc. Other ideas are packing a lot of cheap PMTs into a pressure housing at low cost. So here's a sort of matrix of small PMTs packed in one on layer upon layer into a cylindrical pressure housing, very similar to the pressure housings that Antares use for their optical beacons. And that may actually buy you, there we see a visible photocathode area of 500 square centimeters, buy you a lot of detection area for a little amount of money. Another thing on the wish list really is can you actually determine the photon detection coming in? Okay, instead of just seeing a photon and not knowing where it comes from, can you say something about the detection, the direction it came in from? And there are some ideas out there of using multi-anodic PMTs, possibly a matrix of Winston cones on the top, to actually give you some directionality as well. I'll just skip over these two points because I really don't, I'm running out of time, and I really want to say something about this final slide. As I say, following the workshop, people from Antares, Nemo, Nestor have worked together on this FP6 design study. It's a collaboration of 8 countries, 34 institutes. I think it really does represent the peak of the expertise in this field across Europe. The aim is to develop a deep-sea cubic kilometre scale observatory for high-energy neutrino astronomy and also an associated platform for deep-sea science. The design study was written in March, submitted in March this year. It contained the work packages as given there, and the ultimate goal is to essentially come up with a TDR, a technical design report for a cubic kilometre detector in the Med. I'll just skip site evaluation and go to the conclusions. If anybody wants to ask me about that, great. So, in conclusion, I think the previous talks have highlighted the current status and successes of these, what I've called, first-generation water-based optical Cherenkov telescopes. There's undoubtedly a compelling scientific argument for complementing the planned ice cube array that we're going to hear of in the next talk with a cubic kilometre scale detector in the Northern Hemisphere. Since the last neutrino conference, there's been a lot of positive progress in bringing the EU high-energy neutrino community together towards this goal, and in fact cooperation is already taking place at a lot of levels, cross-calibration of sites, a working group looking at design, etc. A document detailing studies was submitted to the EU in March. We're eagerly awaiting a response from the EU on that. We haven't got that yet, and this is very much the first step towards a cubic kilometre detector in the Mediterranean. Thank you.
So now this paper is open for questions, comments.
You invited a question about site selection. One might naively think that you have 3 sites that are being explored now and you would select one of them. Are there other factors that might you decide to go to a neutral site as opposed to these?
I think basically that whole question is just completely open at the moment. I mean, obviously the bottom line is we have to choose a site that fits the bill in terms of the physics goals. So we want something, and there's the bullet points there, depth, accessibility, so on and so forth. We've heard all the points today. So I think one of the goals of the design study will be to do full evaluations of the sites we have already, to build a good understanding of those sites, to do cross calibrations, and that work's already starting with devices that have been used elsewhere, being used at all 3 sites. And only then, I think, can we really make a decision.
So since you have that up there, Is it politically necessary that it be in the Mediterranean? After all, there's less K-40 out in the open ocean than in the Med.
My personal, and I speak personally here, I mean my personal conviction is working out in the open ocean is going to be much more difficult in terms of sea operations. And I've already said that sea operations is actually sort of one of the big line items in the budget. If you can keep that down and make it nice and easy, then that's when you actually start to be able to cost a detector a cubic kilometre. So that's my own personal, if anybody has any conflicting opinions on that, I'd be happy to hear them, but you know.
Well, just continuing along those same lines, I sort of remember early on there was some exploration about using the ice in Greenland. I guess that's not happening anymore. Was there some decision, or is that simply abandoned, or is that still being considered?
I'm personally not aware of that, but I think maybe some of my Ice Cube colleagues might be able to comment on that. I'm not sure. Yeah, Per Olaf, certainly.
Ice in Greenland is a factor 10 worse than in Antarctica because of all the pollution in the atmosphere. So I had some discussion a long time ago about it, but it's, I think the Mediterranean is the better choice.
But let us thank our speaker.